RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Always look forward to catching up with Farzan Irani for our Money Talk segment on a Thursday morning here at RCR. And Farzan is back after a couple of weeks. Hi, Farzan. Good to have you back. Where are you at the moment? You're still in India?
Yeah. It's always an interesting question, isn't it, mate? Where am I? I'm doing a Houdini act.
Where's Farzan? What's that game that book they used to have? Where's Wally? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Game of Musical Chairs. I'm currently in Asia. So I'm not back in New Zealand.
Okay. Yeah. All right, there's plenty to get through, so let's launch straight into it. And I think we've heard just in the last day or so that banks are lending more to first home buyers with less than a 20% deposit, but there's a discouraging of lending for investment property purposes. So explain what's going on there. Why are they easing up on first home buyers? Is that because the supply and demand is just stagnant?
The first home buyers, as we've discussed previously, when interest rates were going higher, they don't seem to calculate exactly what's going to play out over the first 25, well, it's a long process, 25 or 30 years. They're only short-sighted because they're looking at the average weekly or monthly payment for the first 2, 3, 5 years. Whereas your investors are pretty much switched on because they've done this before, they've learned their lessons, they've got 2 or 3 properties under their belt. Now, what happened was initially house prices started to drop when interest rates were being increased by the Reserve Bank. And we know the Reserve Bank hasn't increased interest rates in almost a year since May. But in spite of that, house prices are now coming down. So the first home buyers were getting into the market thinking house prices are coming down, we can afford these properties. Now, because the banks can see what's happening in the global economy, and as I've mentioned prior, inflation isn't going to come down. In fact, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand and all reserve banks around the world are saying, sorry, guys, we've got everything on hold. And we had promised we were going to reduce interest rates. But the way inflation is playing out, we might not reduce interest rates. Hmm. We'll most probably hold them. But just in case, because the Federal Reserve met last week in the US, and now everyone's freaking out because the statement in there was they might even have to increase interest rates, right, with inflation going up. So obviously banks are aware that if interest rates went up further, first home buyers are the ones who are going to be most impacted by this, whereas investors might have 3 or 4 properties already under their belt with some kind of equity which is favorable towards the banks. And as I mentioned, I won't name the bank in New Zealand, when the global financial crisis hit, and there were people who were greedy investors who had 5, 6, 7 properties. And when one starts going backwards, they all start going backwards, and the bank doesn't care. They'll start selling up 1, 2, 3 properties. So from a bank's perspective, an investor who has 4, 5, 6 different properties, maybe geographically distributed throughout New Zealand as well, is a lower risk factor than this one family who's just trying to buy their first house. Right. Yeah. And it's quite a learning experience, right? When you buy a first house, that's quite a financial commitment. And if the servicing was done, obviously the Reserve Bank has introduced DTI measures now as well, which is a little bit too late, if you ask me. But if one person loses their job out of the two, then the first home buyer is in trouble. And that started to happen. As we've discussed, people are losing jobs as the economy slows down.
So they lend more to the first home buyer?
No, they would lend less. So they would pull back. They would scale back lending to the first home buyer now.
Because I'm looking at that
because
headline.
It's
banks
a more risky proposition.
Are lending more to first home buyers with less than a 20% deposit. Okay.
Yeah, there's two factors in there. So their DTI breakup is if you have less than 20%, they'll lend you more, but you have to meet a certain DTI threshold. Right. Whereas investors, I think they're only going up to about 70. It also depends, Paul, on not just this 20% thing, right? Because the whole reason they've gotten the DTI, because let's say there might be a professional couple who might each be earning, let's say, 150,000 and their joint income's 300,000. So they might afford $2 million property or a $1.5 million property with a smaller deposit, but a husband and wife who own each 55 or 75, or just make a combined income of 150. So in their case, obviously the DTI is lower and the bank might ask them to put up a 20% deposit. So every case is looked at differently. These are just guidelines. The kind of walls that the Reserve Bank is saying, hey, banks, look at this. This is what you've got to do. But the whole thing, again, they're saying they're not going to hold the bank's foot to the fire when it comes to these ratios, at least for a year. They're just soft guidances. So the bank right. should play with it. But now it's too late, as I said. The trains left the station after COVID when interest rates were pretty low. All the people who bought properties and all the first home buyers, especially who bought properties in the last 2 or 3 years, might very well be negative equity or getting close to it.
And mass negative equity is the worst thing, isn't it, on mass?
Yeah, of course, Mike, because let's say the average person, we all know what we're paying rent, how difficult it is at the same time to be saving for a deposit. So some of these young couples who might have really looked forward to buying their first home might have maybe lived with their parents' basement or something like that and might have saved a lot of money.
Buy
and
a
if
van.
They're buying... Well, but let's say they bought $800,000. Let's not get very exorbitant with it. And they paid $160,000 deposit, which they saved over 5 or 7 years. And they bought it at the peak of COVID low interest rates. They've just come off a 3 or 4 year rate, and their property might be sitting at 650 now. So
That's
not only
brutal.
Have they lost, it is brutal because you've just wasted 7 or 8 years building that deposit up because your dream was to own your own house. And now that might be slipping between their fingers, so to speak.
All right. Obviously, budget day today and hours to go yet before we hear that budget. But I see in interest.co.nz, Finance Minister Nicola Willis will use budget 2024 to rein in government spending. I think we're pretty aware of that. There have been a lot of messaging around that and public service cuts, etc. After the pandemic era boost. So, what are you expecting? Kind of a fiscally neutral budget? Because there can't be much room for any spending right now, I wouldn't have thought. But what do I know?
No, they're saying, well, they said Labour open their wallets and they're using this, some of the same terms, which we said that people are drunk and the party's got to end at some stage. You've got to pull away the punch bowl, so to speak. And they said, obviously, the bureaucracy in Wellington had increased a lot. So I just want to read something. There was an article in there. There was a couple of comments in there. Mm. She also said that the public sector department has to cut their budgets by up to 7.5%. And this has resulted in 2,250 employees being laid off and another 1,150 vacancies not being filled. So that's how bloated the government sector was, or the public sector was. 1,150 vacancies not being filled, and they've laid off 2,250 people. And they're saying there's going to be another 500 employees will be losing their jobs in the short term. So that's about 4,000 job cuts, largely in Wellington. So you can see how much Labour had wasted money in that segment, just bureaucratic stuff to make our lives more difficult.
I just added that up, and I assume that on average, they're being paid $100,000 each. That might be slightly too high. At $2,250, well, you'll know, $225 million right there.
Well, it's not just that, Mick. And as I said, 1,150 vacancies that haven't been filled.
Yeah.
So that is a cut as well. That tells you how much wastage was happening in the system at the taxpayer expense. And obviously, nationals come in and said, do we need all this? And as I said, after COVID, what's happened, you just got to understand, even when I've tried to explain this in America, people were saying, oh, the economy is doing so well. Not really, because what's happened since the pandemic over the last 2-3 years, small businesses have shut down. Not a lot of them have come back. People have lost full-time jobs, and now they're taking 2 or 3 part-time jobs. The only reason GDP was going up, there are 2 reasons. One was inflation was up. So obviously something that was $10 is now $12 or $14. So that adds to the number of the overall GDP.
Okay, so that could look like a positive. That could look like a positive or be reported as a positive.
Exactly.
But actually, it's nowhere near a positive.
Yes, and I've kind of explained this a few times because you might say GDP has only shrank by 1%, but without the 6% inflation, GDP could have shrank by 4%.
Yeah.
So because everything is more expensive, it just counted as a whole number as compared to inflation adjusted in some metrics as well. But on the other side, as you've seen in New Zealand, cutting off 4,000 jobs in Wellington alone, now that is going to take away from the GDP. But the other thing is, this is where the GDP looked good because private spending wasn't happening, but the public spending was happening. Because we have things like the green agenda and all of that, all the WEF agendas, the governments had to create all these departments for, I don't know, what was that thing where it's equality and DEI and all that stuff. So now all these people have to look at how organizations doing things. As we said, BlackRock also has ratings and stuff like that for these organizations. So not only some organizations are getting rid of their DEI departments altogether in the private sector, but the public sector had all of these. Same thing in America. So many green initiatives. These are just government jobs being created based on the back of the taxpayer.
I get all that. And I know that you're not pushing that case, but in the end, where does the frickin' money come from, man? I mean, you can sit there and have all these, you know, wonderful, warm, fuzzy things, but you're spending other people's money and you could be crippling them in the long term. Where do they get off doing that sort of thing? It's irresponsible. Sorry, I just had to say that.
No, you're perfectly right there, Paul, but I think that's why we're trying to raise awareness. As I said, none of the education systems, or even me having done an MBA at Auckland University, teach you where money comes from, and they don't even teach you much about the taxation system. In fact, the excuse is that they have to tax us because they take debt, but as I've explained before, they just take as much debt as they want during COVID. Your taxes haven't gone up, but they took on more debt. So what is the point of us being taxed? But the average person has no idea. They just think my government is so nice, and Labor, let's say, might give free healthcare, free dental checks and all of that for the young kids. Where's what you said, the money coming from? It is coming
from
debt.
Don't get me going about that. If fluoride worked, why do you have to give subsidies for dental checks?
Yeah, that's a medical question left for
us. The clown world,
and,
man.
And the whole thing is, I might have red teeth, right? So why do I need fluoride in my water? I'll leave it at that. It's not a one-size-fits-all, just like COVID. And
well, they're admitting it doesn't work.
One-size-fits-all.
By, it doesn't. By having that. Yeah.
But obviously, the budget is the red. We don't know what it is going to be. But they're still in the first year. They're still going to spend $3.2 billion this year. And then they're gradually going to reduce it to $2.85 billion and $2.7 billion as compared to what Labor was going to do, was $3.5, $3.25, and $3. So they're saying, look, we're going to save about $200, $300 million a year. But in the first year, they're still spending $3.2. And that is assuming, they're saying the economy is going to get better, as I've just told you.
Well, it's not going to.
It's not going to because the tax take is going to get smaller. Now, I've just told you, the government itself has lost, 4,000 jobs. It's cutting off. Those 4,000 people won't be paying taxes. Government take goes down. Businesses' GST take has gone down. So where the hell is this number going to come from? So what have I told you? There's a gap. They get in 100, they spend 140. Now they're going to get in 80. They're still going to spend 140. The gap is bigger. They're going to have to borrow more. And with interest rates, the interest expense is higher, which means they get deeper and deeper. Now, yes, I do agree New Zealand has a small debt to GDP, but we're seeing the same example. I think about 3-4 months back, just before, I think around November, we spoke about the US debt. And I told you, it's not a linear event, it's exponential. When it gets to a really big number, it starts getting into the crazy territory. And they're sitting, just back then, we were talking about $32 trillion, they're approaching $34 trillion, and now they're putting on $1 trillion every 100 days. This is not sustainable because now the interest is on that higher and higher and higher amount, and it starts getting really exponential to the extent where, as I've said, certain countries will default.
Yeah. is it correct that China's been bailing out of what have they been bailing out of recently? Selling. What have they been selling recently?
So I think last week, I was in the last week, the week prior, I mentioned China, Japan were the biggest holders of U.S. treasuries, right? So when the U.S. government sells these bonds, as I mentioned, every government sells bonds, somebody has to buy it. So pension funds buy it, insurance companies buy it because it's a steady source of income. So China was one of the biggest U.S. debt holders, but as you're seeing war drums being beaten over Taiwan now, what China has been doing for quite some time is laying off or selling off U.S. treasuries. Now, it doesn't really mean they are selling necessarily. As I've explained, they might have bought a U.S. government bond for 5 years in 2019 and now in 2024. They might have bought, let's say, $1 trillion, or not $1 trillion, but let's say $500 billion. What they've just done is when it matures, they just don't reinvest it back. So they said, thank you, America. Thank you for the interest. We don't want to reinvest it. Can we have the $500 billion back? So China is literally dumping U.S. treasuries, right? Which is sending their interest rates higher because somebody now has to come in and buy new $500 billion that China doesn't want to buy anymore or refinance again anymore. So this is what I'm saying. There's a soft default and there's a hard default. What has happened is America still needs to fund itself from somewhere. It has $34 trillion in debt, of which quite a big substantial amount is coming due in 2024 and 2025. Now, let's say out of that $34 trillion, I don't know the exact number because I don't have it in front of me, but let's say out of $34 trillion, $4 trillion is coming due this year. If China does not refinance that or say, okay, just roll that money over, we'll keep it in there, then what happens? Somebody else has to come in and buy $4 trillion worth of debt. And the day nobody comes to buy that, the USA defaults.
Wow.
And China's selling it because if you are threatening China and you're saying you're going to war, as they've seen, and we know what's happening, Russia, China butting up, the BRICS countries are butting up, they just confiscated Russia's reserves. So now they go to war, as I've just mentioned, China being the second largest holder of U.S. debt, they might just say, stuff, yeah, we're not going to pay the $12 trillion we owe you. That helps us. Our $34 trillion debt is now $22 trillion. And because we're at war, we're just not going to pay you. So China knows this. Now, the average person might think, why doesn't China just dump it all in one go? It doesn't work that way because if you dump it, there's no market for it and you don't find a floor. So China is not stupid enough to dump it all in one go. But as they mature, they don't reinvest the funds. And that's been happening. Now, this has been happening. I was looking at a chart just day for yesterday, I think. And China is literally back at the treasury level that was back in 2009. So it went up after 2009. China was investing a lot of their excess reserves into the U.S. Treasury bills and bonds. And now they've literally been dumping it for all this while. So it's just been going negative. And USA is going to have a big problem because it's making enemies around the world. And the only people who are buying it is some European countries, Japan, that kind of stuff. So the Asian countries might be backing away from these. In fact, I read an article, I think again yesterday or day before yesterday, where there's a company on the New York Stock Exchange that actually invested its, most countries and big global organizations on their balance sheet. And as I've told you, banks also, that's why banks were going bust last year in the US, have treasury bills or bonds on their balance sheet. There's a company out there, a healthcare company in the US, which actually swapped treasuries out for Bitcoin. And this is the second company that done it. There was another company called MicroStrategy last year who did it, and their share price actually skyrocketed because now you're replacing U.S. treasuries on your balance sheet with Bitcoin. I'm not saying that's the right answer because I have a totally different opinion on what Bitcoin will be and what will they do to Bitcoin, and that's for my clients. But these two organizations have done it, and now because MicroStrategy had done it last year, the share price just kept rocketing up because it's on your balance sheet, your company is stronger as Bitcoin prices go up. There's a correlation. There's a medical company just yesterday who's actually now replaced U.S. treasuries with Bitcoin on their balance sheet, and their share price gone up.
And I think Trump also in his speech to the Libertarian Party said he guaranteed that he would protect Bitcoin, you know, so I remember him saying that. And the other thing too, I think the Congress had passed it has to go through the Senate yet, but passed a law that will stop a CBDC being created. Well, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely a great thing in the U.S., but as you said, it's passed in one place and it hasn't passed in the other. But as I've told you before, I knew about 2 or 3 months back from my sources that – they've figured out that if we go the national CBDC route, most people have woken up that CBDCs are not good for the average citizens.
Mm.
And this is average citizens waking up around the world. So as I've hinted, they have figured that out. And when the Federal Reserve has been asked in Congress as well, they said, we have no intention of launching a CBDC in the US. I've mentioned before, they will launch it through their banks. It won't be seen as a national one. And I'm happy to share another one. When eventually, the US dollar will still be the US dollar, but it might not be the global reserve currency into the future, whether it happens in 3 years' time, 5 years' time, 8 years' time. They are trying to get an IMF world coin, which will be the CBDC, which will help settle assets or trades between countries. So as I've just mentioned, when China used to export all their goods to America and they have a surplus, trade surplus, they obviously then put it into U.S. treasuries, which are the most liquid asset in the world besides gold. So that is why the U.S. treasury was seen as the most liquid asset. Slowly, people will now, again, without sharing too much on the radio, IMF is working on a global digital coin and SWIFT, which is the one that banned Russia, through which all the banking system goes, they're getting ready for an international CBDC to settle trade between countries.
Okay. All right. We're up against time. So here's the last question from me. If, as Russia and their second largest bank is warning that the US is inevitably headed for a serious economic crisis, where will that leave us?
I can only say so many things on the radio. Let's just say we're part of the Western democracy, come Western debt-based monetary system. It's a global debt-based system, let's be honest. But the West has been printing a lot of the magic money. And that's why when people say, oh, look at the West, our infrastructure is so good, that is because we have piled on more debt. We were seen as trustworthy countries. Our governments were seen as more trustworthy than the likes of the Indias and the Venezuelas and all of that, in paying their debt back. That's why infrastructure is so good. So eventually how this plays out is the less we Western countries can borrow, the less we'll be able to spend on our healthcare systems, the less we'll be able to spend on our infrastructure. So in a country like New Zealand, we might not have enough funds to then update our infrastructure or renew roads and all that kind of stuff, which then plays up on productivity. This is a long game, so I'm giving you a long game answer. In the short term, as I mentioned before, the US dollar is still the global reserve currency. So everyone needs it till one day people will not need it
till they don't
settle it in a way. But it's a gradual process which has already started, right? People say, oh, is the US dollar going to collapse overnight? No, it doesn't work that way. If you see the share of US dollar in global trade, that has gone down tremendously. There's a chart out there that I've seen as well. So that's gone down. Because the euro is being used a little bit more, but it's mainly the Chinese yuan, which is being used in most of the trades in the BRIC countries and all the development bank stuff that's been happening in Africa and all that stuff in Indonesia and all that stuff. So that is happening. So the US dollar will still be there, but they still need US dollars. People only need New Zealand dollars for one of two things. When you're buying our commodities, and some companies, big ones like Fonterra, might actually be selling on the global market in US dollars anyway. So even someone buying those commodities, which I know are generally in US dollars, might not be needing New Zealand dollars. And there's something called the carry trade, as I explained, after the global financial crisis, when interest rates were really low in America and stuff, or in Japan and in Europe, where there were negative interest rates. Countries like New Zealand and Australia had 3-4% interest rates. That's when the money used to come here, because they have to buy New Zealand dollars to invest in their bank accounts. Yep. If that doesn't happen, and right now our rates are sitting at 5.25 or 5.5, America is sitting at 5.25, why would you bloody put money in a New Zealand bank account when you can get 25 basis points less, but you can put it in the US, which is still the most liquid one? So
I don't know.
The Reserve Bank of New Zealand does have a war chest of a few billion dollars to defend the currency, but you've been seeing it yo-yoing up and down. So I would just probably say people need to diversify, but if you're living in New Zealand, don't really need to, if you're just living and spending in the New Zealand economy.
Right.
Again, nothing, no financial advice on the radio.
No, of course not. Never. Okay, the internet connection has just hung in there. I hope everybody I mean, I could hear what you're saying, but there's a few spots there that have got a bit patchy, but not enough to fall off our chairs and have a big cry about it. So if people want to get in touch, Farzan, tell us.
Yeah, as usual, jump on successsimplified.life.
Successsimplified.life, right?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. All right, Farzan, great to talk again. And the rubber band was a little stretched, but we got there. And we'll see what happens in the budget. And I'm sure we'll be talking about that and other things next time we talk, which I'm pretty sure is in a week's time from now. So thank you, Farzan.
Thanks, mate. Just okay.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.